From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Today at Churchill Downs, the ponies will pace and the swells will shout for the 135th time. Ahead on Only a Game, Jenny Reese has our always entertaining as well as accurate picks. Also, the sad tale of the first Japanese-American jockey and musician Bernie Williams stops by to talk about his stellar career and about baseball, too. Also ahead, a throng of admirers tries to keep up with Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt on his rather fast promotional tour.
Yeah, I'm pumped. I'm ready to go.
You're going to be fast?
I'm making records. Yeah, I'm going to be fast. I'm 46 today. I'm doing all right. I'm going to be, hold on, let me stretch out a little bit. I got to stretch out. Don't mind me, pardon me.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's premature to say they feel their season is in ruins, but Carolina's wish would be to stay clear of the Bruins. Boston stung the Hurricanes with 4 goals to Carolina's 1 last night in the opening game of their second-round NHL playoff series. In the other NHL game last night, Nicklas Lidström scored his second goal with just 49 seconds left in the game to give the Detroit Red Wings a 1-0 edge over the Anaheim Ducks. The two teams meet again on Sunday in Detroit. In NBA postseason action, Dwayne Wade led the Miami Heat over the Atlanta Hawks 98-72. Miami's win evened that series at 3 games apiece, forcing a Game 7 tomorrow in Atlanta. The Western Conference semifinals begin tomorrow when the Denver Nuggets host the Dallas Mavericks. The Mavs beat the favored San Antonio Spurs in the opening round and earned the right to deliver their next playoff disappointment. Triumph in the second round of the playoffs. At least that's what Mavs fans hope will be the case. Here to discuss the Mavericks' postseason prospects is Dallas Morning News sports columnist David Moore, who joins me on the line from Denver. David, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to this.
In order to illustrate the full measure of concern that Mavs fans might be experiencing as we speak, I think we should briefly review Dallas's recent playoff history, which has been fraught with disappointments. What were the worst of those disappointments?
Well, the worst, as it often is, comes once the team reaches the pinnacle, got to the finals in 2006 with home court advantage, were not only up 2-0 in the series against Miami, but had a 13-point lead entering the fourth quarter of Game 3 on the road. From that point on, lost 4 games in that series to lose the finals, then came back the next year, were eliminated in the first round by Golden State, came back the year after that, and were eliminated in the first round by New Orleans. So that is the emotional baggage that the Mavericks were carrying into this postseason.
Well, at least they've made it to the second round this time. A lot of the criticism has been directed toward 11-year Mavericks veteran Dirk Nowitzki over the years. Is this fair, in your opinion?
I don't consider it to be fair, and really I'm kind of stunned at the vitriol that the Mavericks' playoff failures have brought on him. This is a very consistent guy, very conscientious guy. You look at the numbers, he ranks among the top 5 all time in playoff scoring average, and shooting percentage is very high. In fact, he's one of the few players in the NBA whose postseason average actually increases over what his regular season average is. I think it's also, he's not your father's 7-footer. He's not the guy that goes in the lane, bangs away, and gets baskets at the rim. He's an incredible shooter, not just one of the best shooting big men in the league, but one of the best shooters in the league. And I think he's so against type and the fact that the Mavericks haven't won. I think it's easy to label him as soft, and I don't think that's the case at all.
David, sometimes when a team disappoints its fans, not once, not twice, but 3 times or more, you get some kind of funny, comical responses as if in self-defense from those fans. Any of those coming up in Dallas?
Well, there has been an emotional detachment from the fans, certainly not to the level of Cubs fans or some much longer-suffering fans. But there's a sense of, okay, we won 50 games again in the regular season. That's nice. Who's going to knock us out in the first or second round this time? And it's reflected in the TV ratings. You go back a couple of years ago, the season after they lost in the finals, local TV ratings were around 18 or 19, and these were very late games. They were West Coast games. This year against San Antonio, an in-state rival, a team they played very well against, those ratings were 6 and 7. So I think clearly fans are saying, I just won't allow myself to trust this team. I don't want to put myself through this again. And I've gotten some emails along those lines, a lot of emails along those lines, and in much more colorful language than I think I can get across right now.
Well, what do the Mavs have to do this time around to get those people back? Will it be enough to get past the second round, or they have to get all the way to the finals again?
Well, I think fans in every city that aren't in Cleveland or L.A. have resigned themselves to the fact that, you know what, those two teams are going to meet in the finals. Why don't we just enjoy the ride while we can? I would argue just getting to the second round in the West this year, given what they had to get through, I would already term this a successful season for them. But I probably look at it in less passionate terms than I think many of the fans will. And I think many of the fans will say, well, you know what, you get back and you play the Lakers in the conference finals, we'll feel better about you then. We won't expect you to beat the Lakers, but, you know, if you get back there, okay, we'll trust you again.
Over the years, the Mavericks have made headlines as often for the antics of their owner, Mark Cuban, as they have for what they've done on the court, or so it has seemed. What happens if this team doesn't get beyond this round, the second round? Does Mark Cuban break this team up, or does he stick with the guys he's got?
Well, that will be the conjecture, and he's not going to tip his hand. I believe part of the reason he has much more money than I do is he understands leverage and how to do things in a way that gives him an advantage. That being said, this is the same nucleus that lost in the finals 3 years ago to Miami, with one major exception. You've substituted Jason Kidd for Devin Harris. Now, Jason Kidd becomes a free agent at the end of these playoffs. So they're looking at a situation of, do we want to keep a nucleus together that has not had the success we envisioned, or how can we get fans excited about this team going forward? So I believe that Mark Cuban is looking at this team differently now than he has the past couple of years. And I believe if he feels they've hit a ceiling with this group and he can't sell hope and excitement with this group moving forward, he will make some changes to the nucleus.
David Moore is a columnist for the Dallas Morning News, and he joined me on the line from Denver. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
Triple Olympic gold medalist Usain Bolt has dropped out of his first major meet of 2009, the Jamaica Invitational, after a car accident on Wednesday. Bolt and his passenger were not seriously hurt in the crash, and Bolt's manager says the Jamaican track star will be ready to run in the Manchester City Games on May 17th. By then, Mr. Bolt will be considerably more well-rested than he was when he met up with Only a Game's Karen Given last Sunday in Boston.
National Public Radio is going to get 5 minutes of sound on tape, and then we have Soledad, Team, and France 2, okay?
Usain Bolt is a sprinter, known best for running 100 meters in just 9.69 seconds. But this morning, he's in the middle of a three-hour marathon. By the time he's done, he'll have answered questions from 38 international journalists, including a panel of magazine reporters from Eastern Europe doing glossy features on his success, and three Chinese writers exploring his status as a fashion icon in Asia.
Do you want water, sodas, snacks?
As he's attended to by a PR executive, Bolt flops down on a white vinyl couch and pretends to take a nap. It seems appropriate to ask, is this a typical Sunday morning for the fastest man in the world?
No, praise God. Thank God it's not.
When Bolt returned to Jamaica after the Olympics, he was welcomed home by the Prime Minister and received a bronze sculpture of himself in his now famous victory stance, leaning back and pointing to the sky with both hands.
I got a motorcade, people were standing in the rain. It was just overwhelming, really, so it was wonderful.
Bolt's schedule has been filled with appearances and publicity events ever since. But today is the last of it, at least until after the World Championships in Berlin this August. There's a lot of pressure on Bolt this season, from fans and sponsors who hope to watch him break his own world records, to competitors like the UK's Dwayne Chambers, who recently returned from a doping suspension and says he's painted a target on Bolt's back. But none of these pressures seem to faze the laid-back Jamaican.
No, I'm not worried. I don't worry about people. Everybody can say what they want to say, but on the day, you got to produce. So for me, I just go in and do what I have to do. I don't talk about it. So I'm just going out to do what I have to do.
Today, what Bolt has to do is appear in front of hundreds of adoring fans at the Puma Street Meet. Jonathan Vaughn and Radia Buchanan are on the track team at Canton High School and are practicing Bolt's signature point. Actually, they've been practicing for a while.
Since August.
Hold on. Ready? Point. You got to do the point for them.
Radia says someday she hopes to compete in the Olympics for Jamaica, just like Bolt. Her aspirations for today are a little less grandiose.
To meet him? I don't want to race him. I want to meet him. He's going to race him.
I love what you said if you met him.
Trying to ride again.
You're really cool.
Bolt won't be lacing up his running cleats today, but there are still plenty of chances to race him. Eddie Correa is lined up at the speed trap, a short course that times a runner's speed in miles per hour. Bolt tops out at about 27. Eddie's convinced he can match that.
Yeah, I'm pumped. I'm ready to go.
You're going to be fast?
I'm breaking records. Yeah, I'm going to be fast. I'm 46 today. I'm doing all right. I'm going to be, hold on, let me stretch out a little bit. I got to stretch out. Don't mind me. Pardon me.
Eddie reaches down and just barely manages to touch the tops of his toes.
Can you help me up a little bit? All right.
When's the last time you ran for speed?
Maybe college.
College?
That was maybe 25 years ago.
And are you feeling loose? You feeling good?
No, but I'm going to give it a shot.
Across the parking lot, Neville Daly is racing in the 100 meters against a stick representing Usain Bolt, shuttling down the track in world record time. Neville's on a bike to even the odds, but still doesn't even come close to matching the speed of the Bolt stick.
Couldn't do it.
Well, I got to say, like Bolt, you coasted the last 20 meters.
So know what it's like to win easy and lose easy also. I lose easy, you won easy.
Neville is a Jamaican living in Washington, D.C. He took a day off work during the Olympics to watch the track and field finals on TV and was thrilled when Bolt won gold and Jamaica swept the medal stand for the women's 100 meters. Today is another dream come true.
Just seeing him, that's good enough for me. I don't even have to have a conversation with him. Just, you know, being here is exciting enough.
When Bolt finally takes the stage, Neville isn't alone in his adoration. As the crowd crushes in, Bolt poses for photos, takes a spin with a local dance troupe, and runs the slowest time of the day on the speed trap alongside the day's youngest runner. Puma plans future street meets in Paris, Berlin, and Zurich later this year, and other American cities in 2010. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The youngest pair of finalists in the history of the Women's Amateur Match Play Golf Championship of New Zealand demonstrated that experience still counts for something on Tuesday when 14-year-old Cecilia Cho beat 12-year-old Lydia Ko 4-3. Ko, who first played in the championships when she was 7 and distinguished herself then by skipping down the fairways, said, "I just told myself, don't worry about losing. Who cares? Just go for it." Cho acknowledged that she was very nervous and hadn't slept well the night before the final. "I couldn't really see the ball on the first tee," she said, which makes her victory especially remormarkable.
Got the golf in the morning and the playing hook and flew. I dropped the kids off at the park. Said I'd be back to pick them up by dark.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the sad saga of Kokomo Joe, the first Japanese-American jockey. But first, Jenny Reese, who covers horse racing for the Louisville Courier-Journal, is about to join me. Veteran listeners to the program will recognize that circumstance as an invitation to wealth, since Jenny has consistently picked the winner of the Kentucky Derby for us each year since 1994. It's a remarkable string, but then she's Jenny. Picking winners is what she does. She's on the line from Churchill Downs, where the 135th Kentucky Derby takes place today. Jenny, welcome back to the program.
It's always great, Bill.
It is not unprecedented for a teenager to ride the Derby winner. As an 18-year-old, Steve Cawthon won the Triple Crown aboard Affirmed in 1978. Ronnie Franklin was only 19 when he won the Derby on Spectacular Bid a year later. Today, 19-year-old Joe Talamo will be aboard the favorite I Want Revenge. Good match of horse and jockey?
Well, I think that both horse and jockey really impressed a lot of people when they won the Wood Memorial. The horse, through no fault of Joe Talamo's, was left at the gate, and he just was very patient and had to, you know, kind of weave through traffic, and it was the kind of performance you would expect from an older jockey and an older horse. You know, he is quite one of the many stories of this Kentucky Derby.
I understand that young Mr. Talamo has been known to tweet, so many people will know of his every thought and feeling, and he was recently featured on Carson Daly's late-night TV show, which, as I understand it, appeals to the youngsters. Are we looking at the emergence of a new teen idol who will inspire today's youth to embrace thoroughbred racing?
Well, I think it's certainly going to help. He's, you know, he's very tech-savvy. They say he's 19 going on 39, but it'll be interesting to see if he'll be tweeting even before his horse is pulled up after the Kentucky Derby.
Which of the 92 or so horses entered in today's Derby do you think could surprise us?
You know, what's surprising is that with all the defection that there was a full field, but I have a theory on that. Our state legislature didn't get a lot done its last session, but I believe somewhere in the middle of the night they passed a law that mandates there be 20 horses in the Kentucky Derby, because no matter had one horse fallen out, there was at least one more to step in. And so we do have 20 horses for about the fourth or fifth straight year. I would say 8 or 9 horses have a chance to win, another several have a chance to be second. But I do think all 20 of them, you wouldn't be stunned if they finished fourth or fifth.
Well, I do find chocolate candy hard to resist. But at 20-1, maybe a risky rather than a sweet take?
No, I think that's what you look for in this Kentucky Derby. With 20 horses, again, it drives up the odds on all of them. The thing with chocolate candy is I just do not know how a horse owned by Jenny Craig, who, of course, was the diet queen, can be named chocolate candy.
The winner of today's race will instantly become the focus of speculation regarding the Preakness, the second race in the Triple Crown, which will occur in 2 weeks at Pimlico in Baltimore. Assuming that track hasn't been dismantled by a bankruptcy court, how's the financial situation at Churchill Downs these days?
Oh, Churchill Downs is on very solid financial footing. They don't carry the debt that Magna carries, and these Derby tickets, they did hold the price on them this year. They didn't raise them this year. That was their gift back to the fans in this economy. But when you see the price of mint juleps and beers, you know that they're going to be solid for quite a while here.
The profit margin is okay at the concession stands.
Absolutely. And you know what? With 20 horses, each of those owners paid $50,000 for the right to run, of which only 15 of them will earn even a nickel.
Some of the horses in this year's Derby have run only on synthetic track surfaces in their previous races, where they don't get dirt kicked back up into their faces. How big a factor is it that the Kentucky Derby is run on nature's dirt?
Well, I think it's a big factor, and it could be a built-in excuse for a lot of these trainers who insist it won't be excuse going in, but somehow on Sunday morning that all changes. The other thing is, with the weather forecast and chance of rain and stuff, if it's slop kicking back, that's a little different even than just plain dirt. So 14 horses in this field have never run on an off track. So it's a big factor in handicapping. It's one thing that makes an already difficult race to try to pick the winner even more difficult. Who will handle the dirt? Who will handle a wet track? Who will handle clods kicked back in their face? And who will handle the company?
Jenny, I can't remember a Derby where so many of the horses had belligerent, even warlike monikers. I Want Revenge, Musket Man, Dunkirk, Flying Private, General Quarters, and the especially ominous Atomic Rain. Where are the foolish pleasures of yesteryear?
Well, we still have some really sweet names besides Chocolate Candy. We've got Papa Clem, that's named for the owner's father. That's what his grandchildren called him. We got Mr. Hot Stuff, named for the son-in-law of the owner. So we still have the people with the warm and fuzzy side in this business.
Okay, time for you to provide us with the winner. And remember, your 15-year winning streak is on the line here.
That's right. That's right. Well, so I take this so seriously. My problem here is separating some of the really good stories from who do I think can win. I'd been very high on Desert Party that's owned by the Maktoum family, or Sheikh Mohammed, the ruler of Dubai, and I think this could be their year. He's a striking horse. I don't like Post 19, which is O for the Derby. He's my tepid selection over Frisian Fire, who won the Louisiana Derby, and who, you talk about what a great story would be. Frisian Fire is trained by Larry Jones. His co-owner is Rick Porter. His jockey is Gabriel Saez, and those were the connections that had eight bells last year, the filly that finished such a gallant second in the Kentucky Derby, and then as she was almost being pulled out, just freakishly had the catastrophic fractures that led to her euthanization.
For the sake of suspense, I'm going to go with Hold Me Back because I met Bill Mott, the trainer of Hold Me Back, and he's a nice fella.
He is, and also, I tell you what, I'm picking that horse third. He's a very good-looking horse, and he is trained very well. It is so amazing. This race is so difficult to handicap. When you look back on it, you're thinking, I can't believe I picked that horse last year. I saw my picks recently. Except for the winner, of course. I always have the winner. But some of my other picks were a little strange, I thought.
Jenny Reese handicaps the Kentucky Derby for Only a Game each May, which is pretty much why I look forward to the race. Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you so much, Bill. Always a pleasure.
For a brief time in a series of obscure venues, Yoshio Kubuki demonstrated that he was a heck of a jockey. Unhappily, he came into prominence of a sort at just the wrong time, which, for Yoshio Kubuki, was 1941. In Kokomo Joe, the story of the first Japanese-American jockey in the United States, John Christgau tells the story of Yoshio Kubuki. John Christgau joins me now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be here again.
Yoshio Kubuki was born in the U.S. in 1918, and the challenges began immediately, I gather, or is that an exaggeration?
No, it's not. The challenge in 1918 was a flu epidemic that began in the Far East and was sweeping the world and hit the White River Valley of Washington, which is east of Seattle, where Kokomo Joe was born, and eventually wiped out his entire family, including his mother, who died 4 or 5 weeks after he was born. So his father sent Yoshio, along with three other siblings, back to Japan to be raised there by an aunt. But by that time, the epidemic of Spanish flu, which killed 50 million people worldwide, that epidemic had struck Japan, and all three of his siblings died in Japan within a year of arrival there in 1918.
And there was a certain irony to his being the only survivor because he might well have been considered the least likely to survive based on his birth weight.
He was so small that his father joked that he could carry him in the pocket of his jacket, and and that stayed with him most of his life. When he finally came back to America in 1934, he was less than 5 feet tall and weighed only about 85 pounds.
Fairly shortly after returning to the U.S., Kokomo Joe, who didn't quite have his nickname at that point, encountered a man named Charlie Brown, a trainer. Tell me about Charlie Brown's influence.
Charlie Brown spotted Kokomo Joe riding at the Phoenix Fairgrounds in 1940. Charlie Brown was himself an owner and a trainer who had hung around horses for a long time, and jockeys. So he knew a good jockey when he spotted one, but what he saw in Kokomo Joe was a certain recklessness and carelessness and greenness. So he took Kokomo Joe under his wing, became his manager, and then he took Kokomo Joe to the Gillespie Ranch in the middle of the Sonoran Desert, and it's where Kokomo Joe really learned to ride.
John, we probably shouldn't go too much further without letting people know how Yoshio Kabuki became Kokomo Joe.
There had been a huge race scandal, and 20 or 30 jockeys had been summarily dismissed from riding and had their licenses taken away. And Kokomo Joe said, well, I'm small and I'm strong. Maybe I'd make a good jockey. So he went to Santa Anita, hung around, hoped that he would be able to begin to exercise horses, which is where all jockeys begin. But those turf guys who hung around there also made some racial comments about him, but also couldn't pronounce his full name, Yoshio Kabuki. So they hung the nickname on him, Kokomo Joe.
Kabuki's success as a rider began several years after he arrived, and it culminated on one extraordinary day at a county fair in Ferndale, California. Describe the jockey's achievement on that day.
The fair ran Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And on Thursday, on the last race of the day, there were five races each day, he won the race. Then on Friday, five races, he swept the card. He won all five races. And it was a feat that nobody could remember ever having been done by any other jockey. And in fact, it was a North American record, sweeping the card. Then the next day, on Saturday, the first race, he won. So he had won seven consecutive races. It was news that reached even San Francisco and excited everybody in Northern California who was following racing.
You write that even as he was winning every race on the card that day at Ferndale, quote, the noose of suspicion was beginning to tighten around his neck. What was the nature of that noose, and to what extent was Yoshio Kabuki aware of it?
I don't think he was much aware of it, but the noose of suspicion went all the way back to 1798 in the Alien and Sedition Laws that provided for the arrest, detention, and removal of all enemy aliens in the country who were from the country that we were at war with. And those alien enemy laws remained on the books through World War I and were responsible for the detention and internment of numerous Germans throughout the country. And that was the bureaucratic antecedent for what happened to Japanese Americans in this country in 1942. All of the detention centers under the Alien Enemy Act had been set up and created in May and June of 1941, before the war.
What was life like for Kabuki in the internment camp to which he and so many of his fellow Americans of Japanese descent were sent?
It was horrible because he was going to be as good as Willie Shoemaker or Johnny Longden, Eddie Arcaro, or any other subsequently great jockeys. He was going to be that good, and he had had it snatched from him, and all he could do was sit and think about how the best years of his racing life and his jockey life were passing him by. That irritation and that bitterness and that sorrow kept with him his entire life until he was an adult.
I'm talking with John Christgau, author of Kokomo Joe, and you're listening to Only a Game. To what extent did Yoshio Kabuki feel free to resume his career as a jockey after the war had ended and after the internment camps had been emptied?
He tried to return. He went north to the Washington and Oregon Fair Circuit to try to resume his career. He was not successful in getting mounts. He even went as far as into Vancouver, Canada. Eventually, he wound up training horses on the same ranch where Charlie Brown had introduced him to horse racing and trained him to be a good jockey. And one morning there, he was exercising a horse. Another jockey, reflecting the considerable anti-Japanese animosity that was still in the air in 1946-47, forced him into the rail, and he fell off the mount, broke his leg, broke his hip, smashed his kneecap, and wound up hospitalized for almost a year in Arizona. When he finally got out of the hospital, his leg was frozen, and Kabuki, obviously with a leg that was frozen at the knee, could not become a jockey, and it was the end of his jockey's career.
Tell us about the end of Yoshio Kabuki's life.
Finally, with no place else to go and really no income, a man who had seen him ride in Sacramento at the county fair there in 1941 offered him to live rent-free on a ranch outside of Galt, California, which is just south of Sacramento. And it was on that ranch that he lived from 1985 till 96 or 7. And it was there that he learned he had incurable and inoperable cancer. In an effort to make sure that he did not suffer prolonged pain and despair from the cancer, he took his own life. But the sadness and bitterness that had haunted him all his life was part of that motive also, I'm sure.
John Christgau is the author of Kokomo Joe, the story of the first Japanese-American jockey in the United States, published by the University of Nebraska Press. He joined me from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Decordova Museum and Sculpture Park, presenting modern and contemporary sculpture and art on 35 acres, 15 miles from Boston in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Details at decordova.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It must have been a towering challenge for the judges in the International Fantasy Hair Competition to pick a winner. One contestant carried a 3-foot sculpted cherry tree on her head, and she only stood 5'1" without the tree. Another, Kelly Norton, sported what was described as a giant puffball of tufted hair clumps and chain mail. Asked whether she intended to preserve the do for work the next day, Ms. Norton said, "Actually, I might have to. I think it's welded to my head." Asked about the secret to success in the fantasy hair contest, Melody Longobardi, who wore the 3-foot cherry tree, said, "Pain. Lots and lots of pain."
Good morning, starshine. So happy to be my love and me as we sing our early morning singing song.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, baseball's best guitar player, or the only man on the Billboard charts who's hit over 300 8 times in the big leagues. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for Look the Week's News. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
So, Mr. Hot Stuff, hold me back, or I'm likely to join in the dance. Or you could give me advice, because otherwise I'll have nowhere to hide. What name of Mr. Ed am I talking about?
Well, I want revenge, damn it!
Now we've got almost all the horses named.
If you want the Derby pick, I'm going to go with I Want Revenge, because there very rarely been a horse that so suits my mood.
Mm-hmm. And so you agree with the experts? This
is at the recent experts. He's become the favorite over the last few days, because apparently he had, you know, terrific workouts since he's been at Churchill Downs. So yes,
tonight the Boston Celtics and Chicago Bulls will play Game 7 of what some people are calling the greatest NBA series ever. What do you think? A bit hasty with that conclusion?
I'm not entirely sure. After the game the other night, just when you thought, gee, you know what this series really needs is a triple overtime game, You get one. There have been some incredibly good and some incredibly bad plays in this game, but as an ongoing drama, I can't think of one that's better than this. And it's a first-round series.
Absolutely. The Lakers and the Rockets begin their Western Conference semifinal series on Monday. The Rockets have advanced to the second round for the first time since 1997. Tracy McGrady of those Rockets is out for the season, but no doubt that he still has his teammates' backs, right?
I have absolutely no idea why he did this, but he went on the radio and was asked who would win the championship, and he picked the Lakers. and then he said he thought Cleveland would get there, but Cleveland's not really that good. But he pointed out that Houston has no chance.
Be true to your school doesn't really extend into the pros for Tracy McGrady.
Well, he knows he's gone after this year, so he's making himself popular on the way out.
Charlie, based on what you've seen so far in the first round, is there any reason to believe that the 2009 NBA Finals won't be between Los Angeles and Cleveland?
I still think Los Angeles is going to wind up with a bump in the road somewhere. They're probably going to get there, but they're going to come closer to not making it than Cleveland is.
Today's playoff game between the Penguins and the Capitals features two of the NHL's best players, and they don't particularly like each other, do they?
No, they got a little nasty with each other this year, but Sidney Crosby and Alex Ovechkin playing against each other in a playoff series is exactly what the NHL ordered. Of course, they're going to have a little trouble on NBC because their game might wind up running into clippity-clop, clippity-clop, I want revenge!
And the network said, just make sure your game doesn't go overtime or we'll put you on a network that no one can find.
We're going to go to Versus, the former Really Big Fish network.
The impact of the swine flu, or at least concern about same, is being felt throughout the world of sports, Charlie. This weekend in Mexico, 176 soccer matches will be played in front of crowds ranging from 0 to 0. China's diving team has decided to stay home rather than compete in the FINA Diving Grand Prix next week in Florida. High school sports programs in Texas and Alabama have been canceled. I wonder if American pro sports eventually will be affected.
So far, they haven't. The Texas Rangers have said they don't have any immediate plans to do anything differently. So far, the professional sports will not do anything radically different, although the NBA is apparently keeping its eye on the situation because of the Rockets making the next round.
On Wednesday, the International Olympic Committee revealed that several athletes who competed at the Beijing Games had tested positive for banned substances. I don't know about you, but I was flabbergasted to learn that some of those athletes ride bicycles.
It's unbelievable that cycling would be one of the venues through which performance-enhancing drugs would get into the Olympics. I am shocked, shocked to tell you. But, of course, the most significant one to me is the fact that Bahrain finally had its first Olympic track and field gold medalist, and now Bahrain has its own Black Sox scandal. What a thing.
J.C. Romero, the Phillies reliever who was suspended for the first 50 games of this season after he tested positive for a banned substance, has sued the company that manufactures the supplement that Romero took. What are the chances that he will prevail in this?
I think he's got enough to get to court. I think he probably isn't going to win once he gets there. The supplement he was suspended for was androstenedione, the famous stuff that Mark McGuire was using quite legally in the 1990s. It's not listed in the ingredients, so he's essentially suing them for being negligent in manufacturing it and or false advertising. He's got a case, not a great one. I think this will progress a little bit, and it may even soften his suspension a little bit.
And speaking of suspicious substances, according to a new book about Alex Rodriguez, the former Texas Ranger had a clubhouse attendant to get his toothbrush ready for him after every game. And do you suppose he had assistants getting his footy pajamas prepared as well?
Well, I wondered if he had someone to taste his food, because it sounds like he wasn't tremendously popular in the Texas Rangers clubhouse. I think it's open season now. Every anonymous accusation that can be leveled at the guy will now have a ton of credibility, and it's going to be 8 kinds of circus when he finally comes back to play baseball, if in fact he comes back to play baseball this year.
Apparently unsatisfied with post-baseball activities like dating Madonna, inventing fine prose, and bludgeoning former Partridge Family star and boxing phenom Danny Bonaducci, Renaissance man Jose Canseco has a new passion. What is it?
He's going to try mixed martial arts, which, given the fact that Vi Sikahema, the Philadelphia Eagle, beat his brains out the first time he went into celebrity boxing, I don't like this chance. Canseco claims he needs money, which pretty much guarantees we're going to get another book out of him about this whole thing. It's really sort of amusing in a way that people are sort of giving Canseco a pass because it turns out people were actually doing steroids. The guy's still a clown and a circus act.
Niki Lauda, who is 60, has decided that he wants to go really fast at least one more time, and he's not going to be returning to Formula One racing to do it. How do you feel about his most recent choice of vehicles?
Well, he wants to be a space pilot. He wants to pilot Richard Branson's commercial space vehicle. I would caution Nikki that if you're up there in Earth orbit and you go into a skid, it doesn't stop. You just skid.
Yeah, but, you know, it'd be cool. Because,
but you won't hit anything, right, probably, exactly. Although it's a little crowded up
so
there.
So what? Yeah. You know, it's not like you're going to go into the wall. And finally, Charlie, no mugger with any sense would ever attack a football player, a boxer, a wrestler, or a martial arts master. But now I guess that we should add at least one other category of athlete to the list of folks that would-be muggers should avoid.
Don't go near the marching band girl with the baton. A 17-year-old marching band, I guess, majorette, I guess is what they used to call him, was assaulted, and after punching one of her assailants in the nose and kicking the other one in the groin, thereby disabling them for the real fun, she beat both of them with her band baton. They should count themselves lucky, by the way, that they didn't assault a Glockenspieler, because those people take no mercy.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time right here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
And I got to say Glockenspieler.
I'm just a humble radio host, born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org. You're listening to a tune called Lullaby for Beatrice, written and performed by Bernie Williams. While he was learning to play the guitar, Mr. Williams scrambled to support himself by working for the New York Yankees, where his duties included playing center field and hitting over 300 eight times. The composer, guitarist, and former American League batting champion joins me now in the studio. Bernie Williams, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
I hope you didn't take that amiss.
No.
You struggled to support yourself working for the Yankees.
Well, it was a struggle at the beginning, but you know, managed to make a fine career out of it.
16 years, a fine career indeed. Lullaby for Beatrice is lovely. Tell me a little bit about how you came to write it.
Lullaby for Beatrice, it came as some sort of an accident, I guess. While I was teaching my daughter how to play the guitar one winter, she must have been about 9-10 years old. We started playing, and we came up with a couple of chords that we sort of call it her song. Mm-hmm. A couple of days later, she asked me, Daddy, let's play our song, and I completely forgot it. I completely forgot everything about it. I didn't know what was it, and I promised her that I was going to make her a song. And that same night and during the next couple of days, I worked on Lullaby for Beatrice, and that's how it came.
Very pretty. Very pretty.
Thank you.
Years ago, I asked one of your former teammates, Wade Boggs, how old he was when he first knew that he would be a major league ball player. And he told me he was 10. How old were you when you knew that you would be a professional guitar player?
Well, I would say probably 40. Well, I think that part of my essence as a human being is being a guitarist. Everybody that knows me, you know, well enough knows that I'm always with a guitar in my hand and always listening to music and always practicing and playing, whether it was in the clubhouse, on the bus, on the plane rides, everywhere that I went. So I guess I should consider myself a professional guitar player right now, but I never really saw myself as that.
How did your teammates feel about the fact that you always had a guitar in your hand? I'm tempted to say, did anybody ever say, hey, shut up, I really want to listen to this other stuff?
Well, I can't even count the amount of times that happened. Especially on plane rides, you know, after a hard game on the field, you know, everybody wants to get some sleep on the plane. And I'm usually sat behind Derek Jeter in the plane rides, and I would play my scales and my arpeggios, and I started rocking a little bit in the back. And he would say, Dude, I'm trying to get some C's right here, man. Cut me some slack.
Think of all the championships the Yankees would have won if Derek had gotten more sleep.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That may be debatable, though. But all kidding aside, I think they have been, you know, very supportive of my endeavors as a musician. Even when I make the first CD, The Journey Within, I remember seeing Derek and Jorge Posada and Mariano and at the concert. So, yeah, I think, you know, they certainly appreciate the fact that I can do something else than playing baseball.
You last played with the Yankees, with whom you had spent 16 seasons, in 2006, but you played for Puerto Rico in the World Baseball Classic this past spring. Did you hear from any major league teams after those games about possibly, you know, maybe you'd re-up?
Well, I've always thought that I can't really do two great things at the same time. Hmm. So I figure rather than pursue something that, you know, I've done before, I'd rather challenge myself and sort of reinvent myself and pursue this great challenge of making music and being in the music industry.
So the title of the current CD, Moving Forward, suggests moving forward beyond baseball.
Yeah, certainly. I think, you know, that this transitional period between, you know, being a full-time Major League Baseball player and now being a full-time musician, I think, you know, this CD certainly marks that period of time.
Tell me a little bit about how the two compare. Is there any overlap in the sense of how you approach each challenge?
Oh, yeah, no question. I think for me, it comes down to the just having a similar mentality. You have to do your work. You have to, in baseball, is, you know, hitting the ball, doing the soft toss, you know, the running and the hitting and the throwing. In music is practicing your scales and arpeggios and listening to music and learning music theory and harmony and all of that. To me, the mentality has to be there. My goal is not to miss a note ever. So it's a pretty high goal, but I think in the pursuing of that goal, it will make me a better player each and every day.
The last track on the CD, a live track, features an artist with whom some of our listeners may be familiar. You know, this doesn't seem quite fair. A lot of kids grow up dreaming about becoming Major League Baseball players, and the ones who don't, they grow up dreaming about playing rock and roll in front of thousands and thousands of screaming fans. How come you get to play center field in Yankee Stadium for 16 years and jam with Bruce Springsteen?
Oh, man, I feel incredibly blessed. And I don't know, I feel very lucky and very fortunate to have the opportunity to meet him actually at certain points in my career, because before I was able to have the opportunity to jam with him at this Safe at Home Foundation dinner 2 years ago, I met him quite a few years before in the Yankee clubhouse, and I had my Fender Telecaster there in my locker room, and I was like, well, I don't want him to sign a baseball, you know, why don't he just sign my guitar? And then he wrote to Bernie, if you ever get tired of baseball, Bruce Springsteen. And who would have thought that, you know, a few years after that, I was going to be playing with him in the same stage, jamming to Glory Days.
Terrific. I like your rendition of Take Me Out to the Ball Game on the CD.
Thank you.
I would like you to play it for us. But first, let's listen to the way that old favorite begins on the CD.
Your attention, please, ladies and gentlemen. Now batting for the Yankees, number 51, Bernie Williams, number 51.
How hard was it for you to convince longtime Yankees PA man Bob Shepard to lend his voice to your project?
I think it was not that hard at all. I think he was very receptive to the idea of participating in the recording of the CD. And for us, you know, as a team, we were certainly very honored to have him. And I think, you know, it just gave a nice, fitting ending to the CD, you know, to have him introduce me as he did, you know, for 16 years, you know, of me playing in Yankee Stadium. You know, it was just very nostalgic in a sense and melancholic, a little sad in a way. But I think it was just very appropriate.
So in the Moving Forward, again, to use the terminology of the CD, what happens next? Where do you see yourself going with this?
My short-term goal would be, you know, to have as many people as possible to listen to the music and you know, to let them know that this is not a novelty or a vanity project. You know, this is something that I'm putting a lot of time and effort into it, and hopefully it'll show with the way the music sounds and the way that my playing goes.
Well, at the risk of people taking it as something of a novelty, I'd like you to take us out with Take Me Out to the Ball Game. I know it's not a novelty. I've heard the rest of the CD, but would you do that for us, please?
Absolutely.
Bernie Williams, guitarist and center fielder. His current CD is Moving Forward. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Howard Gelman at KQED in San Francisco. A fond adieu to Only a Game intern Brian Fadham, who has not only served with distinction here, he was also a standout as half of BU Hockey's unofficial mascot team. Best wishes, Brian, and take care of the hot dog suit. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's Usain Bolt photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from 46-year-old sprinter Eddie Correa, whose hubris diminishes just a bit before he tries to top the time of the world's fastest man, Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt.
Do they have, like, on standby, like the ambulance or anything like that? Like,
I don't know.
Well, you better get one. Call one now.
Well, you bet Bolt beats the ambulance to the hospital. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.